So I was, of course, was gone last week for spiritual direction class. And I've shared before in homilies that finding the right coffee for me was a struggle. And so it was homily worthy, at least I thought it was, when I found the right coffee that I could drink. And so since then, you know, I make myself my cup of coffee or pot of coffee, as the case may be, in the morning. I'm no expert, and I'm not exactly what you would call a coffee snob. I'm somewhere right in the middle. I mean, in the morning, any port in a storm, I typically need a cup of coffee to get going. But I'm not terribly exacting because I can't make the world's best cup of coffee. But normally, I take my coffee with me to Mundelein because the options there at the seminary are not very good. Well, in the rush of getting ready to leave last week, I just did not have time to get my own coffee ready to take. So I was stuck with the seminary coffee that's closer to syrup than it is coffee. And so I do my cup in the morning to get me going and kind of suffer through it. Yesterday morning, I finally had the chance to make my own coffee, and I made it the exact same way that I have been making it for about the last year. And it was the best cup of coffee that I remember having in a really long time. As far as I know, I didn't do anything different. And yes, we know the old line, right? The absence makes the heart grow fonder. But there's also something more than that that goes on. Typically, when we're deprived of something and go back to it, we actually see it or experience it with fresh eyes. New things stand out to us. And so it's good for us at times to go away from good things, to come back to them, to see them anew, to receive the goodness that has always been there that perhaps because of our familiarity we've missed. And so I really want to look at what St. Paul gives us in his letter to the Romans today with that lens, because we have heard this reading or variations on it quite a bit. Paul spends a good deal of time speaking to not just the Romans, but the Corinthians as well and other communities about what to do with the spiritual gifts that are given. I assume this is not because Paul is carrying out some sort of ancient time and talent survey, but instead because there really is a deep importance to understanding not only why God gives the gifts that he gives, but also the fact that it is God who gives those gifts. So we need to start there. That's oftentimes the thing that we speed past as we start talking about the spiritual gifts and the talents that God's given us. God is the origin. God is the one who gives these things. They aren't innately in us. They're only things that sometimes through practice we can enhance and grow in. But God is the origin. This is another way of saying God doesn't make junk. There's this kind of contempt that is in the culture that we've been sort of taught, if we're not people of faith, to resent and hate ourselves. Or maybe we see that where we talk about human beings as being sort of an infection on the planet, or where we've ceased expecting good things from other people and start looking at them with suspicion. All you have to do is dive into kind of pop culture and social media, and this is the way that we approach each other. But God doesn't make junk, and we need to hear that also in the Christian life, because sometimes there can be such an intense focus on sin that it becomes unmoored from the rest of faith, and we start to believe the lie that the evil one wants us to believe, that God made junk when he made us. And that is not true. God has entrusted intimate and personal gifts to us precisely because he loves us. He didn't need to do it, but he chose to. And to reflect on the great generosity of God in giving gifts to us is deeply important. And we need to avoid comparing gifts, because that's the next temptation that we start to fall into. Paul, like I said, is not looking to do some ancient time and talent survey. Instead, he's wading right into the fallen human heart that falls prey to comparison. Either we look at others and say, they've got more gifts than me. They must be better than me. Or I've got a few more gifts than this person. What must I have done to be so amazing? And it's very subtle. It's oftentimes not that bold-faced. But nonetheless, if we find ourselves sorrowing around others, having a hard time being near them, might bear some reflecting. Am I comparing my gifts to theirs? Am I comparing my responsibilities to theirs? If we're looking anywhere about our gifts and our responsibilities, it needs to be to the one who gave them, to the Lord himself. Or if we find ourselves looking with undue frustration and anger at others, is there perhaps a little bit of presumption and pride that's taken hold of us? Why can't they get it? Maybe the Lord is, again, asking us to look at him to learn his compassion, as well as a bit of humility. But then Paul becomes even more practical. Right? He asks us to first focus on living the gifts that we have. And I think this would bring about a beautiful harmony in our lives individually as well as in the life of the church. What are my gifts? Okay, it's there that I will give myself. It also means that I'm not going to try and boss others around. I'm not going to try and interfere and control the flow of things, but instead to give where God has given me to give. Again, the whole orchestration, if you will, flows from God rather than from us trying to sort it out on our own. It's this beautiful reminder, even in our gifts and our responsibilities, that God has not left us alone, but remains intimately involved in our lives and in the life of his church. And then the last half of this homily, again, I think it's here perhaps that we are most tempted to give in to that familiarity that leads us to miss the beauty. Hate what is evil, hold to what is good. We've heard this before, right? When Jesus says, anyone who does not hate father or mother is not worthy of me. So yes, hatred of evil means this deep resistance to it. It means ultimately that we would become so formed to have the heart of the Lord that it would be repugnant to us. But first and foremost, it means making the choice to say, I will not be involved with it. The rest of it starts to come over time. Our emotions typically are the slowest thing to conform themselves to God. Hold to what is good. And we know that, right? The good is not immediately attractive to us. We have to hold to it. So to remind ourselves that it's okay if we don't like it when the alarm goes off and we have to get up to go to church. Doesn't mean we're bad disciples of Jesus. It just means that we're human and that there is yet more that God needs to do. It doesn't mean that we suddenly feel warm fuzzies towards everybody. Paul will have a little more to say about that later on, right? It instead means that I will choose these things and not worry too much yet about my emotions. Choice. Choice is what matters. Cooperating with the grace of God offered to me. Love one another with honor. So, love one another with honor. This means a little more than the Hippocratic oath of do no harm, but instead seek to honor one another. Easiest way to do this is to begin in our own households. Again, there's a place where familiarity can breed an inattention that leads us to lack honor in the way we approach each other. Siblings, how are you guys helping each other out at home? Do you sometimes maybe take on each other's chores when the other one isn't feeling well or is tired, or just because that's a good thing to do? Husbands and wives, how do you approach one another after 10, 15, 20 minutes of marriage, or years, as the case may be, right? How do we make sure that honor still flows through those bonds of love? How do we love with honor our co-workers, our extended family? Again, these are things we need to talk to the Lord about, not to come up with the ideas all on our own, but instead to allow his spirit that he gives so freely to flow through us and inspire the creativity to love with honor. Be not slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope. I quote it so often, but it's one of my favorite quotes from Teresa of Avila. God, save us from sour-faced saints and silly devotions. Right, we all know that old stereotype that those who are disciples of Jesus are sour-faced and lacking hope, only seeing the things that are wrong with the world and just general bores to be around. It doesn't mean that we all suddenly become extroverts and, you know, goofy to be around. But it does mean, how often do I smile versus how often do I frown? Something very simple, like that. What occupies my thoughts? Is it the stuff that's wrong with the world and with me? Or is there a bit of gratitude? Is there a willingness to look and see the good that peeks through sometimes the cloud rack of the darkness of the world? That becomes the signs of hope that we begin to rejoice in, that then resonates with the true hope that we experience, of course, here at Mass and in our moments of deep union with our Lord. Be patient in tribulation, persevering in prayer. This flows right from rejoicing in hope. Not only does the world want what it wants right now, but we as fallen human beings want what we want right now. And that includes the triumph of the good, God being victorious. But that is not the way God has worked. Go back to the apostles. They thought Jesus was going to be coming back really fast. And here we are over 2,000 years later. God does not work on our time scale. And so when we find that impatience setting in, we should again turn to the Lord honestly and say, Lord, here is my impatience. How long, O Lord? And then to wait and to experience the fact that, yes, we wait for his final victory, his coming, but he hasn't left us alone. He doesn't expect us to just flounder about, but he becomes the source of our perseverance and our patience. Share the needs of the saints practicing hospitality. This is something that this community in particular just so beautifully edifies me in. But it's something we always should be reminded of, to have an eye towards those who are new to us in this community and then outside in our world. Are we willing to share a bit of what we have, to welcome others into our happiness, into the stability that we experience? This is something that was powerful in the early church. It's powerful in its community, right? We share the needs of others so that no one is found wanting. But also we show hospitality so that those who are outside of our community find the joy and the peace and the authentic love that is here and not out there. Now it gets hard. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. I find it interesting that Paul sort of doubles down. It's pretty clear from scriptures and the story of St. Paul's life. This is a man who was consumed with passion. Passion that oftentimes manifested itself in anger. And so perhaps there is this willingness to kind of double down, knowing how difficult it is that our Lord's love is shown in his willingness to go to the cross, and even from the cross to bless, saying, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. This is hard, especially where now it doesn't seem that there's just a sort of vague distaste for us as disciples of Jesus, but there is more an out and out movement against us. It can be very easy to want to throw verbal hand grenades back over at the other side. But then we hear these words, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. What does that look like? Does that look like including them in prayer? Not just that they would stub their toes or get hit by a meteor, but that we would really pray that God would do them good, the supreme good of being converted in heart, but in his time, with that patience and perseverance, praying for their good. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Have a heart that can be moved and attach itself to others, wherever they may be. Again, imitating Jesus, who enters into the world to pitch his tent with us and take on our joys and our sorrows. Be of one mind towards one another. I know we long for that in the church, that we would all believe and live the same things. But it goes even deeper than just believing what Holy Mother Church teaches, but being of one mind with one another. How do we come to authentic unity that, again, flows from Jesus, who cares about us enough to say, I will be one with you? Do we make clear what is our own preference and so can be set aside in humility? And what are those things that we must hold to because we hold to unity with Christ first? This is an art, again, that by focusing our heart on Jesus, we start to learn. Do not set your mind on high things, but condescend to the lowly. Again, this is all in imitation of Jesus. I was speaking with a brother priest at my spiritual direction class this last week, who has never celebrated the extraordinary form, knows that I do, and so was just asking me a bit. He was asking about the last gospel and asking kind of, okay, what's the point of that? Well, we know that the church sends us out on mission, ite missa est, go in peace, as we say in the ordinary form. And that captures the same spirit of why the last gospel was given. But the last gospel extends that a little bit more deeply. That it isn't just echoing back to the end of the gospels when Jesus says to the apostles, go out and make disciples of the whole world, go and do something. But instead, we are sent out being reminded that we don't just obey Jesus, we imitate him. The Son condescends to be with us. He takes on flesh. That the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That in going out on mission and entering into the rough and messy stuff of the world and our own lives is not just doing something Jesus said because he's off at a distance somewhere, but we're doing what Jesus has done. That Jesus, who descended in the incarnation, and at each Mass who descends in the Eucharist, and then in each reception of Holy Communion descends to be in our hearts, invites us to do the same, inviting us to go where he has already gone and where he already is. So we need not be afraid of what humility may ask of us. If all of our life is about having our heart be like Jesus's, then this is where that learning begins, and so it's where our reading leaves off. So as we approach Jesus again in the Eucharist this weekend, let's bring the water jars of our hearts, the things that are very familiar and mundane and ordinary, and allow the power of the Lord that turn those things into the finest of wine to transform the ordinary for us also, that it might be enriched and reveal his glory, just as that wine at Cana did. And so in doing, find God waiting for us among what had before been only ordinary and familiar.